Welcome to the FutureCast, the Institute for the Future's ongoing conversation about signals of emerging innovations and disruptions that will make the future.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the FutureCast.
Today is April Fool's Day 2010, but this is no April Fool's Day call. This is a very real thing. I'm Jerry Mikulski, your host. And with me virtually are several IFTFers, Kathy Vian, Jemé Cassio, Tessa Finlev, as well as our guest, Vinay Gupta, calling in from London, from Brixton more precisely. We will hold these calls monthly, but not on a set schedule. We'll post the podcast to iTunes and the IFTF site, and our live chat is actually on Twitter with the hash FutureCast. Forward about these calls to anyone who might be interested. And then one last request, when you jump into the conversation, please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's call starts with something called a hexayurt, then applies it to relief efforts in Haiti, but then we're going to place this effort in a larger context of development worldwide. And we have with us as our guest Vinay Gupta, whom we met through, MyFTF met through the Superstruck game last year. Vinay, you just want to tell us sort of the meeting story. How did you end up bringing the hexayurt project to Superstruck? How did that sort of play out?
Well, I mean, basically, Superstruck was this enormous opportunity to do public thinking about really tough scenarios. And it actually turns out there's very little public thinking around really tough scenarios. So when I heard about the game and I saw the terrain it was covering and the problem definitions, which are incredibly sharp, then it seemed like something that was really important to get involved in. And a lot of the way that I've developed the ideas that I'm kind of known for is based in science fiction. You know, science fiction is really where we've done a lot of our best thinking about the future for several generations. You know, it's the global center of foresight. So it's kind of natural to adopt essentially science fiction as a way of talking about these ideas.
Science fiction gives us a kind of moratorium where if you, in science fiction worlds, all that drops. You can play with humanity, you can play with the future, you can have dystopian, utopian, whatever. So it's where there's lots of good thinking that can be done.
Exactly. And, I mean, Superstruck really nailed down a very, very hard, very solid scenario that was, you know, dealing with all of these problems, which are completely real. You know, Superstruck was about dealing with the real world as it currently stands in a slightly science fictional way. But 10 years, there's really no time at all, and none of those were tech problems, right? I mean, it was hunger, it was disease, it was... you know, governance. It was all the stuff that's a real problem just pushed 10 years further down the line. It was, you know, the science, like they always say, science fiction is about the present, not about the future.
Yeah, exactly. And you had already created the Hexayurt, or did this come up as an idea for the game?
No, Hexayurt project goes back to 2002. So I invented it in response to... an event called the Sustainable Settlements Charrette from the Rocky Mountain Institute. So it was a workshop of about 80 people from something like 40 different groups who were examining what do you do about humanitarian response. They specifically wanted to reinvent the refugee camp. And one of the things that they were really enthusiastic about was trying to find a what they called a relocatable shelter where you could have these big camps of, you know, 500,000 people. And then if you got an opportunity to send people home, you could send them home village at a time. So if you build people concrete houses, you lose the ability to move them. And if you can't move them, they're no longer refugees. You just go pick up a whole bunch of additional citizens. So it was invented as something to give people what I refer to as a tactical solution to a strategic problem.
Yeah.
So the strategic problem is how do you manage refugees? The tactic is... you put them where it's good for them to be, and then when you need to move them, you can pick up the hexayurts and shift them.
Can you describe the hexayurt?
Sure. The simplest hexayurt, and it's hexayurt.com if anybody's looking at this and they have a computer by them, is a six-sided shelter, which is 15 square meters or 166 square feet, and it looks like a little silver hut. It's a six-sided silver hut. The wall's 4 feet long, 4 feet high, but 8 feet long. Got six sides and a shallow roof. So the whole thing stands about 8 feet high. So it's big and low and squat and incredibly cheap. A hexayurt US prices is about $100 worth of plywood. If you want to build it out with something insulated, it goes up to being $200. And in essentially modified styrofoam, it will stand up to a 60 to 80 mile an hour wind. because it's just very, very solidly engineered. The shape is inherently very strong because it's Buckminster Fuller style thinking.
And so it's sort of a geodesic dome that's collapsible, right? It's collapsible in the round, like one of the paper ornaments that you would put up?
Yes, exactly. It concertinas up. And, I mean, it came out of me trying to figure out how to build geodesic domes with less waste from standard materials. Standard geodesic is 25 to 40% waste when you cut out 4x8 sheeting materials. So although domes are theoretically very efficient, practically you wind up with an enormous amount of junk on the cutting room floor, and that's very, very bad. So, you know, I'd been trying to figure out how to make efficient geodesics for ages. Finally get an efficient geodesic design, but the only way you can get an efficient geodesic is you have to sacrifice the geodesic property. It's quite ironic, really, if you're into that kind of thing.
It is.
But, you know, nonetheless, it looks like a geodesic. It kind of sort of works like a geodesic. It's incredibly cheap. There's only really one size that works. You can make it a little bigger or a little smaller, but it's not like you've got infinite fluidity of scale. They're always about 15 square meters or 166 square feet. And they're just dirt cheap. Whatever you're going to make them out of, it's probably not possible to make a cheaper building out of that specific material.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be an important property because being able to know with some confidence that what you're doing is as cheap as it can possibly be is a very, very strong argument to make in terms of field deployment.
Right.
It's just
exactly.
Not going to get any cheaper because it's a zero-waste cutting plan for a plywood hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So let's roll the clock forward to the Haiti earthquake and sort of how did things unroll for trying to bring the hexayurt to relief efforts in Haiti? How were you connected and what happened?
Well, so the Pakistan earthquake was really where we got serious, right? We worked very hard to try and get units organized for Pakistan, and we didn't succeed. So when Haiti happened, I was much more psychologically prepared for get on top of the problem on day one, write something powerful that advises people on what to do, and start knocking on doors. And that's exactly what I did. I wrote a piece called Hexier Country that was picked up by Wired and Boing Boing and a few other places that basically proposed an open-source hardware national-level reconstruction plan for Haiti. And what came out of that and a sort of associated publicity and conversations I had with people was contact with 15 or so different NGOs that are operating on the ground in Haiti. The largest were probably Oxfam and Save the Children, U.S. Southern Command, which is not a charity, but I had a conversation with the chief scientist about using the hexayurt there, all the way down to these very small, fast-moving church groups, which are, you know, they've got their chain of command is basically the parishioners, the pastor, and God. And so, yeah, that's where most of the innovation happens in the humanitarian world, is U.S. church groups.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it turns out that Pastor Fred, before he was a pastor, was a builder or, you know, a general contractor or an electrical engineer. So they often bring quite a lot of technical capacity to the field that's not normally there, and there's nobody above them to tell them that's not policy. So they often have a lot of practical skill and common sense in their relief efforts. Certainly not always, but it's not uncommon for them to be pretty technically sophisticated in a way that's fairly surprising. So I've had all of these conversations with all these groups about actually doing hexayurts in Haiti, and now we're in the long wait. Because what we've got is the traditional tent strategy has failed in Haiti already. The UN isn't giving out any more tents, neither really is anybody else, because everybody acknowledges that the tents are too expensive, the shelter isn't very good quality, and the summer storms are just going to wipe the tents out. So we got 1 million people in the field waiting for shelter. They're currently under plastic sheets for the most part. And the question is, what are we going to do with them? Right? You can't put them back where they were because those areas are still 4 feet deep in rubble. If you build them transitional shelters, the transitional shelters are something between $1,000 and $3,000 a unit. So 1 million people, let's say that's 250,000 family groups, might be 200,000. $1,000 a shelter, that's $250 to $750 million. That's like a quarter of the reconstruction funds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are we really going to send a quarter of the reconstruction funds on 3 years' worth of housing? I'm not seeing that. It's certainly not happening. They've only built about 1,000 of these transitional shelters. So they've met, you know, a thousandth of a percent of the actual need for shelter out there. And that's, what, 3 months after the disaster?
Mm-hmm.
So we're in this gap, and the only thing that I'm aware of that fits in that gap is the hex year, because it's incredibly cheap, it lasts for a few years, and you can pick it up and move it. So you can build them where the people currently are, and then when you clear their old neighborhoods of rubble, they can pick the hex year up and gang carry it with their 20 closest friends and resite it in the position their old house was at. And then they can live in it for a couple of years while they rebuild their former place. So we're basically just, you know, continuing the conversations and continuing to move things forward with the expectation that because nothing else will work, eventually somebody will get around to trying a hex here. And, you know, I might sound fairly good-natured about this, but it is a little annoying that all of the support that we've had from the international organizations in 8 years of operations is, that's a really interesting idea, call us back when somebody's done it. But we think that the problem in Haiti is so bad that they might finally be forced to innovate, and we are right there with them when they're ready to go. And, you know, I mean, this sounds a little callous, but as a one-man operation, right, Hexyart Project is very specifically not a 501c3. It is an unincorporated personal effort, right? Because, you know, it's just one of these things where the one thing that we cannot do is raise a bunch of money, go out there and start building Hexyarts, and retain the possibility for the Hexyart to become a standard option for groups like UNHCR, right? We have to be a technology vendor, because as soon as we step across the line into being a field charity, nobody else will touch the technology that we promote.
Well, if somebody just had sort of plywood on the ground, could they start building Hexyarts themselves or with local materials?
Absolutely. Right now, right? I mean, you know, you need a general contractor with a screw gun, a saw that will cut plywood sheets, and you can make one this afternoon.
Yep, and what's the average cost of a Hexyart?
U.S. prices, it's less than $100 for plywood. U.K., it's about £100. Haiti, plywood prices oscillate depending on supply and demand, so it's probably pretty expensive. But if you build a lot of Hexyarts, you can buy it cheap in Florida and ship it in a boat. I had a friend call Weyerhaeuser, you know, their big wood company out there, and attempt to order 3.6 million sheets of plywood just so we could get some notion of the price and difficulty. Yeah, it was quite fine, right? He called them up expecting it to be a big order. They're like, no, that's actually not very large, man. We supply Home Depot. And we're like, okay, that's good to know. So there's no supply chain issue there. You know? It's really easy to do, right? It's so easy to do, nobody will try it until they get to the point where nothing else will work.
Right.
And this sounds cynical, right? But if you think about it, why are we still using World War II style relief tents in all of our long stay refugee camps?
Well,
there's no innovation in sheltering.
Progress is often shockingly slow. You probably know this because you know so many different things of how development works, but how many years do you think it took for the British Navy to adopt sending lime juice aboard ships after the day when a British captain returned from a 4-month cruise at sea with a healthy crew, having proven that lime juice worked?
Oh, 60 years?
150 years from the point where a maverick captain goes out with a crew, comes back with a healthy crew. And remember, scurvy is busy making everybody's teeth fall out, their gums bleed, everybody is weak. You come back with like half a crew, and the half that's alive, that's sort of still kind of working, is totally debilitated, right? He proves he can cure that. It takes 150 years.
Wow.
So anyway, progress is sometimes slow. I think we're getting a little better than that. But let's bump up from that for a second and just talk about, you know, rethinking Haiti and rethinking not just disaster relief but development broadly. And I'd like to sort of go a little beyond Hexyart into other components of what it would take to settle people in a way that would make them actually viable, that would let them thrive in the longer run and be content locally, you know, as long as they could be free sort of from local politics or whatever other sorts of things are stressing them nearby. But what's the kit that would help, and, you know, this is all your beliefs, but what's the kit that would help people create inexpensive livelihood that's very local and very sustainable?
Okay, so if you put, let's say, you know, 100,000 hectares in a field, the next thing that's going to happen is massive epidemics of waterborne disease, right? So you need toilets, and you need some way of filtering water. So on the toilet side, there are a whole bunch of pretty decent composting toilet designs. Sulabh in India, S-U-L-B-A-H, is a big charity that's got a toilet design that works in an enormous number of different places and is about $10 to $20 in materials a unit. Really, really simple. Locals can build them. Off you go. Water filters, there are really two good technologies that I'm really in favor of. One of them is the biosand filter, which is basically a large concrete bucket filled with gravel. And the other is the Butters for Peace Filtron, which is a big clay pot that sits in the top of a five-gallon plastic bucket. And both of these have excellent microbiological reports from places like MIT. They're good working $10, $20 a year technologies. Tata, you know, the car company and industry in India?
Yeah.
Tata is just in the process of launching a $20 water filter in India, which is some kind of coated gravel product. It's probably some kind of power plant ash kind of filtering thing. But that's incredibly cheap and will probably become the standard global solution for doing clean water filtering at a household level.
That's
an incredibly exciting project because, you know, all this stuff, you know, I'm just saying about, we talk about bottom of the pyramid businesses. You hear people talk about bop this and bop that and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying, you know, look, Indian and Chinese businessmen have a very special name for the poorest 20% of the population of their countries. Customers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, we've been making good money selling to the incredibly poor for the entire history of history. And the idea that that's some kind of novel breakthrough is just, it's a Western dream, right?
Right.
They've got money. It's the same as everybody else's. There are a lot of them. Find something that they need, sell it to them. So Tata potentially will get the marketing for this thing right, and the product design may be right. So that may turn out to be the global solution to dealing with water problems in most of the villages. It doesn't handle transport, but at least it gives you purification at the household level. Then you look at Haiti, and Haiti has this very interesting revolutionary history. So they did massive land reallocation, they did huge land reforms, and now they've got something like 600,000 farms with the average size below 2 hectares. And most Haitians own at least some of the land that they farm. So what you've already got is the potential for a massive investment in Haiti's agrarian economy to give them food self-sufficiency. And it turns out that their farming methods are incredibly primitive, so you've probably got a doubling or even a quadrupling of yields, measured either as calories or as dollars, sitting right there waiting to be done, just by improving the know-how. So you've got
and the yields would the yields come from different planting different crops, using different techniques, all of the above? What?
Primarily, it's better technique. It turns out that a lot of people aren't doing things like plowing. So, you know, they're losing an enormous amount of their seeds on the surface. And, you know, you can, even if you don't want to plow, you can at least punch holes in the ground and drop the seed down the hole. If you add a little bit of fertilizer, even if it's, you know, just common or garden compost, you can still get much better seed start. You know, in general, they just have no idea how to farm in the conditions that they're in because they don't have any research budget. So the stuff that you would never think of doing, they're just not doing.
There's actually a movement now, just sort of a revival of a movement toward no-till farming, and a lot of people are doing much more intelligent things with sort of the variety of crops that they plant and using natural, you know, insecticides, basically insect-repelling plants, et cetera, et cetera, to make it all work. So plowing isn't always a good thing either. It tends to tear up your topsoil and let it run away.
They've already got such massive erosion problems, but... You know, it's always a case of finding what's going to work for them where they are. Biodynamics is a good answer.
So what else is the rest of the kit? And then I'd like to invite Kathy and Jamay and other people on the call to ask you questions as well. But what else would comprise this development kit or this sustainability kit?
Well, so there are four levels that we're operating at, right? There's the individual household, which is the Hexier, and it's a stove to cook on, the water filter, the toilet, a couple other little bits and pieces. And that handles your household family-level stuff. Then you've got what you need for groups, and groups are communication, transport, and some kind of working space. So communication, we've pretty much got covered in Haiti. They've got pretty decent cell phone access. Transport is a very interesting question. We can talk about that more if anybody's particularly interested in transport futures. Organizations, they're going to need to rebuild a lot of their organizations more or less from scratch, but that's a little above the stuff I normally do. And then finally, at the top level, you've got the five functions of the state. And this is all part of this model called state in a box. So the five functions of the state are: it needs an effective legal jurisdiction, effective organizations, international recognition, a perimeter for the land that it's got administrative control over, and a list of the people who are members of it. And all of that is basically still intact in Haiti because it's an island. Whereas if you go to places like Central Africa, a lot of that's missing. So Haiti's got the potential to go from where it is to being an unfailed state in a fairly direct manner because all of the fundamental structures they need are still there. They haven't had a breakdown of legal jurisdiction. They haven't had a breakdown of international recognition. So basically, you know, if you think about Port-au-Prince, if you get the hexyurts in place, you get the water filters and the toilets and the stoves and all the rest of that stuff in place, then people are stabilized at the lowest level of survival for the 2 or 3 years it takes them to rebuild a functioning economy. And that, I think, is as much as we could possibly hope for in a relief effort.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you. Kathy, Janae, what questions do you have for Vinay?
Well, I think, Vinay, this is Kathy. I think you started to say something about this earlier on, but I'm wondering about the whole question of scaling this up, not so much from of what.
Sorry, that was a motorbike.
not so much from the point of view of, you know, what it takes to you know, bring the prices down on the supplies and things like that, but to what kind of support and what's the path to scaling this to quickly respond to things worldwide? I mean, we're looking at a decade in which I think we'll probably be seeing more of the kinds of things that we're seeing in Haiti right now. And so how does this scale?
Okay. So there's two sides of this. There's the materials side and there's the know-how side.
Mm-hmm.
So all the materials that we use are incredibly common. I think you could make basically everything that is required out of plywood and concrete. So those are both materials which are an enormous use. They're not available everywhere, right? I mean, if you go to, you know, rural parts of the world, you're going to run out of supply chains for plywood and concrete. You're either going to bring them in trucks or you're going to find a different solution. But if you're within 400 or 500 miles of a major city, that major city was built with plywood and concrete. So that's the material side. The material side, we're okay. On the know-how side, you'd never, ever, ever want to be doing something for the first time in a disaster. Ever. So what we need are local regional programs in areas which are disaster-prone where people design a hexyurt that works for them. They figure out how they like their windows, how they like their doors, how they need to, you know, how they need to bulk it up to handle their local wind conditions, how they need to handle snow. You spend a few years monkeying around with a couple of dozen hexyurts sitting in a field for an annual cost of well under $100,000 until you've found a design that just works locally. You know how to build it. You train lots of people how to build the design that you agree. Then when something breaks, you just throw materials at the situation and your local military and builders work together to train the rest of the population to build as many as they need. But it's absolutely critical that you don't expect to come into a situation and design a hexyurt which is exactly right for that location the day after a disaster. You want to do the design work, the localization work, years ahead of time because it's very inexpensive, but it's not fast.
Also, Vinay, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I can easily see with what I picture as the design of the hexayurt that this could become a lot like Lego building blocks and that people could create all sorts of modules that plug in, expand, enhance, link together hexayurt designs. I mean, it's a hexagonal building block in many ways that can be outfitted from the inside and that can be connected to other things from the outside.
You betcha. I mean, it's a room, right? If you think about a single room and then you can connect modules together into houses – or schools, or whatever it is you happen to need, make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and first you give everybody one room, and then when everybody's got one room, you start giving the larger families a second room, and, you know, you go from there until you've got your population properly sorted.
Mm-hmm.
I really like your focus on the, you know, sort of figuring out in advance the sort of local implementation of it. And, you know, on one hand you think, well, you know, this is such a simple form. Why would it need to be localized? And yet we know that so much of development efforts have really stumbled on the failure to localize something that, that really makes sense for the local groups. I'm just wondering, and your focus on, you know, having people there in the, in these various disaster-prone areas. I mean, we have maps of, you know, what are the disaster-prone areas for the next 100 years. How do we get organizations and people engaged in at those particular sites doing this kind of, you know, sort of pre-design work?
God only knows. In general, people don't prepare for disasters at all. In general, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Bangladesh floods every few years. How well organized is their response to flooding looking to you? Huh? I mean, they know they're going to mm-hmm. flood it again. They've adapted in a lot of ways, but it's not a slick machine that goes into action every time a flood happens, right? It looks a little bit less like the first time every time it happens, but it's not like it's a well-oiled response. It just kind of springs into action, takes care of business. In the good times, nobody wants to waste money responding, and in the bad times, nobody's allocating blame for why there wasn't preparation.
So maybe there's another way into the market to prove Hexaearth as a demonstration project and to make them be something that is actually a normal, positive thing, not a measure as a disaster relief or prevention. In fact, sell them as tool sheds for people with bigger houses with gardens, or, you know, commercialize them in a way that they have a legitimate positive purpose somewhere, including as low-cost housing for people in shadow cities. And then at least knowledge will get percolated through, and people in a disaster will then say, oh, wait, we've already got these things.
Absolutely. Have you been to Burning Man lately?
Not the last year or two.
Okay, so Burning Man is basically hundreds of hexyards every year, I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I look around Flickr, and it's just like it's all of these hexyards, and I've had no contact with the people building them. They're just downloading the plans and going. So, you know, it's coming out slowly. But, you know, we don't – it's one of those things where it's always dawn for like 3 or 4 hours when you're waiting for sunrise. You know, we're probably within the next 6 weeks to 3 months going to see somebody in Haiti pop up with, you know, 20 minutes of camera footage of the half a dozen hexyards that they just built in somebody's parking lot to see if it would work. And at that point, once you see a real field deployment, at that point the thing is very likely to go viral among the NGOs because somebody will have taken the risk of trying it, and once somebody's tried it, off you can go. And it's had pretty good organizational penetration, right? I've talked to 4 or 5 national Red Crosses. U.S. Department of Defense really likes the hexyard. They built them in the garden in the middle of the Pentagon 3 times. You know, it's gotten a lot of exposure, but getting it operationalized means going through the humanitarian innovation firewall, and it just takes a decade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if anybody really wants to throw some resources at doing this stuff, Science for Humanity is raising money right now to do structural engineering to make sure it won't blow over in Haiti. You know, they can throw a little support to that, find friends in Haiti, get them to build some, do some testing. You know, the idea is for this thing to be a big, broad-based, open-source effort. It's not intended to look like a charity in any configuration. It's intended to be collaborative research to solve the world's biggest problems.
Right, right. Tessa, did you have a question for Binay?
Yes, I do. And it's perfect. You just mentioned the innovation firewall. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more about the struggle that you face with this project in terms of bringing something innovative and somewhat obviously very useful to relief efforts, but it being outside of the usual parameters of what's standard or what's normal. And you mentioned that the earthquake in Haiti has been so drastic that the relief community might just be forced into a corner where they have to accept the hexaearth. But for organizations that might not be thrown into the middle of a crisis like the earthquake in Haiti, what kinds of strategies have you developed through this project that you could share with other organizations?
So the primary reason the HEXER is a success is because I'd read Thomas Kuhn's Anatomy of a Scientific Revolution when I was a teenager. And what Kuhn says is, look, you know, scientific revolutions, and the example he uses is relativity and quantum mechanics, scientific revolutions happen over the course of a generation. Somebody demonstrates conclusively that the old model is inadequate, and then you have to wait for all the people who are currently professors to die or retire before new professors will teach the model. So I invented the HEXER in 2002, and I made the estimation that it was going to be 2015 before I saw large-scale deployment. Right, I figured out it was going to be about a 15-year lag, and I've acted on that information by making sure that the HEXER project was what I call a cockroach, because it has no funding, it will not die of not being funded, and as long as I continue to, you know, pay the web hosting and keep the idea circulating and I don't get disappointed by people not doing anything, eventually I will win. Now, I mean, that kind of patience is not common, but it's incredibly effective, because it means that you'll see in 5 years an entire generation of young NGO people who've grown up wondering why the HEXER wasn't being used and now have some seniority. See? Simple. Now, if you want to do innovation fast, you've got two choices. You can get into the front line and go out into the field with an innovative technology, or you can go through the military route. And I'm not going to the front line, because going to the front line is a sure way to get people killed, either me or somebody else, because it's the wrong approach. So going through the military has turned out to be spectacularly effective in terms of teaching my ideology. The whole thing about simple critical infrastructure maps and six ways to die and all the rest of this stuff. If you look for a thing called Defense Horizons, and number 70 is a paper on a thing called Star Tides, which is basically I co-authored with the former chief information officer of the U.S. Department of Defense, specifically talking about how you can use decentralized research networks to do humanitarian support. So, you know, it's gotten a lot of support over there. But again, you get this problem inside of DoD about you can sell it all you like to guys like, you know, there's a problem here, but actually putting it into the field is the decision of some major who is responsible for why night and responsibilities. So, you know, there's no shortcut to doing life or death innovation in the humanitarian domain. And the evidence for this is the refugee camps, which look exactly like refugee camps did in World War II Europe. They're still deploying essentially military surplus-looking equipment into places that the gear was never designed for, while the military has gone through 5 generations of tents and shelters, and the hikers and climbers have gone through more like 8 or 9 generations. The humanitarian world just doesn't do innovation. So, you know, we're really looking for something that has never happened before to happen, and it's not going to be fast. The lesson here, and it's not a particularly exciting lesson, is you've got to be willing to wait your entire adult life to have your idea go forward.
Yeah, patience does pay off, unfortunately.
Yeah, and, you know, this
think.
Is something
we think
where,
anyway, it's reputedly it pays off.
Well, it's just something where we've got to, you know, we've got to look at the evidence around us, which is it takes about 10 years to get anything done. You know, I mean, Kevin Kelly talks about how, you know, he plans his life in 5-year slices. So if you start teaching people when they're young that it's going to take them 5 or 10 years to put a substantial dent in a problem, then they can begin to organize their lives and their expectations around that. Rather than looking for quick fixes, we start training people for the long haul and to have rational expectations about the long haul. And this is a much harder thing to sell than let's all accelerate the pace of innovation, but it's actually corresponding to what we see in terms of ground reality. It's not ideologically appealing, but it corresponds to the way that things actually are. And this is a general theme, right? I mean, you know, the whole core of the piece that I wrote, HEXER Country, was basically suggesting that the first thing you've got to do in a situation like Haiti is count the dead and figure out what they died of, and then count the dead in an ongoing fashion. Does anybody know how many people are dying a week in Haiti because of waterborne disease? I'm not sure anybody even has the data. But if you don't count what people are dying of, how can you know whether you're allocating budget in an intelligent way to prevent them dying? All of this stuff comes around to taking the bad news right on the nose.
Let me invite other people on the call to jump in and ask questions as well.
Hi, Vinay. This is Jamay. I was wondering how much thought or how much experience do you have with making hexayurts out of other materials? Because I'm just thinking with Haiti, there's a real problem, as you mentioned, with access to wood. And it seems to me that there might be an opportunity to do some guerrilla design or some guerrilla production of hexayurts using scrap material, essentially, or stuff out of landfill. And I was wondering, have you done anything like that?
No. Generally speaking, so two sides. Firstly, we can make hexayurts out of anything that's a 4x8 sheet. So, there's all kinds of inquiries about making them out of hemp products, and there's some kind of sort of building boards made out of things like foamed recycled plastic, all of which looks fine. It should work. The issue is scale. That in Haiti, we're looking for shelter for 1 million people, and relatively quickly you run out of scavengeable resources when you're going after those kind of scales. So even if we could find enough to do, a couple hundred shelters to get started with, then we would be faced with this issue of having to go back to the conventional design just to get enough materials to do the rest of the population. And in general, one of our sort of rules of thumb for the Hexayurt project is you've got to be thinking about 100,000 person deployments as pretty much the minimal real size, because that's about what the NGOs expect when they're talking to vendors for things like tents. They're looking for something that can deal with about, their sort of minimum order is about 100,000 units. So basically, yes, it'd be a good idea, but I haven't pushed it very hard because it doesn't move us all that far forward in terms of the long-term agendas, so I've prioritized other things over it.
So this makes building in Florida and shipping things in sort of a pretty viable strategy because you're not going to find the materials on the ground in Haiti.
Well, they've already got plenty of plywood in Haiti because they're using it for all kinds of other purposes. But if you're talking about the kind of scale of reconstruction we're talking about, you basically call Weyerhaeuser or one of the other companies and just be like, look, we want this much we want this much plywood and this much 2x4 on the dock in Haiti. How much will it cost us? And they'll take care of the logistics from Florida, or you'll have the logistics leg from Florida to Haiti taken care of by some commercial shipping company. Because you're dealing with thousands of tons of materials. It's cheap, but it's not light.
Let me invite other questions. Anybody else on the call who'd like to ask a question, or Kathy, or Tessa, or Jemaine?
One question I have.
Two for you, Vinny.
This is Kathy.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Again, this might be, the kind of question that you would ask at the end, but I'll ask it right now. Those of us who are listening, or we're parts of networks and all of that. If we wanted to really help move this effort along, what would be the best way for us to get involved? How could a grassroots network support what you're trying to do?
So there's two sides to this. The first is people, and the other is money. And money is the easiest one. Science for Humanity right now, which is a UK charity, is trying to raise about $5,000 to do structural engineering on the Hexayurt.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to figure out conclusively is what level of wind load will a plywood Hexayurt stand up to, and what are the cheap modifications we can make to get more business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a simple thing there. You go to hexayurt.com, there's a link, you click on it, there are some people who will take a little cash off you, and that fundraising appeal has gone glacially slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's been out for about, 6 weeks, and they're maybe halfway there, because it turns out that getting people to fund research is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard. So the first thing is, fund some research, right? And if you guys want to fund some more research, Potters for Peace could use some money, and the Biosound Filter people could use some money, and Aprovecho, the stove guys, they're researchers too, they could raise some money. Because all of these appropriate technology things are shoestring projects, because the big charities don't touch appropriate technology. And they certainly don't do any research.
Why is that?
I wrote a paper on this, an article anyway, called Saving the World on the Cheap. The basic issue is that if you look at medical research, you've got an ethics board which will tell you whether or not the experiment is reasonable and take responsibility for any mistakes that are made or any unfortunate discoveries, right? And you also have dedicated money, which is designed to be wasted doing research to prove that things don't work. See?
Mm-hmm.
So in the environmental, sorry, in the humanitarian world, there's no equivalent of an ethics board which will sign off on the work that you're doing as a reasonable experiment. Mm-hmm. They don't do double-blind trials. They don't do single-blind trials. They don't do any kind of trials at all in which you divide a population into two and give one half one approach and the other half the other approach. They don't do it. They consider it to be unethical because what happens if one group does better than the other group? I'm like, that's how medicine starts. They're like, we don't care. This is not medicine. And then finally, you get into this problem of having dedicated money. So when a charity goes out to raise money to go and, you know, feed the orphans, the expectation is that the money is going to be spent buying food and doing logistics and paying for staff and advertising. When you say we're going to do research to feed the orphans, then everybody says, but you're taking money that could be spent feeding people and using it on research. That's not what we raised the money for. That's an abuse of the funds we raised. And then you try and raise money for research, and it turns out to be incredibly difficult. See what I'm saying? It's an enormous breakdown in the innovation structures inside of the humanitarian world, and that's why we're still putting people in World War II-style disaster relief tents.
So interesting. Anybody else on the call with a question for Vinay?
Oh, actually, I wanted to come back to the second part of that, which was that's the money side.
Yeah.
Oh, the people
I
side,
apologize.
Right?
Sorry, yes, what's with the people? Yep.
So the people side is what we need are freaks. Right? We need, right, intelligent innovators who are interested in solving the world's problems, and we need these people to work together, right? I've got an ultra-cheap housing technology. You can use it for anything that you need to do ultra-cheap housing for, right? You give me a little bit of a push, and I can sort you out with, you know, toilets and water filtration, all the rest of that stuff, so we can support an arbitrarily large population at a high standard of living almost anywhere in the world. Tell me that there's nobody out there with a problem. Oh, I've got, you know, 7,800 Tibetan nuns who are being relocated. We could use this to build their monastery. Okay, great. Well, I can work with you to do that. Oh, you over here, you happen to have some, you know, you see what I'm saying, right? What I have is a component that can solve all kinds of different problems for all kinds of different people. That's why they're building them all over Burning Man. It turns out to work great for that environment. So building a network of people who are working on things like this, somebody comes and says, well, I've got this little solar lighting module. Would that help you light your hex yurts? Yes, it would, right? Collaborative innovation networks are what make the open source world work. And finding those people in the humanitarian game is extremely difficult because they're not highlighted, they're not superstarred, and generally speaking, you've got people knocking on the doors inside of these organizations having the same dialogue that I'm having from outside, inside. And
so what's
finding
happening
that
to these, what's happening to these relief agencies and the NGOs and the other kinds of organizations that are involved here, why are they not forming up around in these collaborative innovation networks that you're describing?
They're competitors.
Mm-hmm.
They're all competing for the same dollars from members of the public making small donations, so they don't naturally think about collaboration. And I mean, there is some good news, but we haven't gotten there yet, right? The reason that humanitarian aid is so incredibly inefficient, the reason that the refugee camps have terrible mortality rates and horrible living conditions, the reason that the people living in refugee camps have no political say in how the money that is raised on their behalf and in their names is spent, is because the NGOs don't innovate and they're constantly competing with each other for grant funding and for small donors.
Mm-hmm.
And the image that they project to the world is largely rooted in what will raise money from small donors, and it has very little relationship to the way the organizations actually operate. Because, you know, if you think about it, imagine you were running a refugee camp, right? You've got a couple of million quid a year coming into your hand, and you're responsible for taking care of the needs of 50,000 people. So pretty soon, once it becomes clear that those people are going to be there for 30 years, you're going to naturally think about organizing some kind of political representation for them so you and they can partner in how the money is spent. If they've got cell phones, you might even think about things like electronic democracy so that they could vote on their relative priorities for things like, you know, do you want the better quality rice or the better quality lentils? We can't afford both. Here's the money coming in, here's the money coming out, how do you want it, right? These are the sorts of things that you would sort of naturally evolve over time, right? That's not
happening. We would. You'd think we would.
well, that's what we would do if we were in charge of these things, but we're not in charge of them.
So let me step to one side of this discussion for a second. And you and I had a really interesting discussion, and one of the paths we pursued was, you know, mobile phones have made it into many, many people's hands in the world. They're now more than half the population of the world, we think, has a cell phone or access to a cell phone, maybe through the village phone lady. And you presented sort of two paths that might take. They were dramatically different paths. One was sort of dystopian, and one was actually pretty utopian, but in what some people will perceive as a dystopian way, at least for them. Can you describe that some?
Okay. So, I mean, this is kind of – how are we doing for time, by the way? Let me just check that.
We have another 10 minutes or so.
Okay. All right. So I'll be brief because I can't look at the time on my phone when I'm on a call. It's weird. Anyway.
The
problem.
I will warn you when we're getting close, and then I need to do a summary at the end of the call. So go ahead.
Splendid. Okay. So here's our basic situation, right? We are the richest 0.5%, 1%, 2% of the world, and our countries represent the richest, say, quarter, right? And for, let's say, since the end of the Second World War, we have allowed the developing world to rot, right? We just have. Their kids are dying in gutters, and, you know, we are arguing about whether or not we can have much larger cars or enormously, obscenely larger cars.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We've done wrong by the entire world. We're doing wrong by economically, environmentally, and militarily. The governments of the Western world blackmailed the entire world. They threatened them with nuclear apocalypse where they would kill the entire human species over a debate about how they were going to divide up scarcity in their societies. We're insane and we're evil. And this has to be faced head on, because what is about to happen is that the poor are going to become empowered, right? You're getting into this situation where, you know, right now we've got something like 4.1 billion cell phones in play. Pretty soon the entire human race is going to have a cell phone, and they're going to be devices a lot like iPhones printed on single sheets of plastic and retailed for $30, something like that. The phone technology is just going to – do you remember what phones were like 10 years ago? That's how much better they're going to be in another 10 years. They're going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. They're going to be cheap, and they're going to be everywhere.
They're going to be disposable,
so
pretty much.
Boom. The world is just going to be saturated with phones. Now, there's two ways that the poor, who are going to be righteously angry with us, can react. The first is they can look for a political solution. The second is they can look for a technological solution. If we ship the phones with videos that show them how to double their farming output, build stoves, build toilets, build water filters, you know, build all of the needful things, how to treat cattle diseases, how to treat their own diseases, crop diseases, if we have university-level education in 20 different subjects, shipped on the handset in a, you know, 2 gig of RAM that's just tucked in a corner, then what will happen is that the poor will be offered an open door to a much better life for themselves and their families, which is primarily constructive. They can generate value that was not there before by mastering their environment and by mastering basic science. And this is a utopian vision. We could actually have a world where the poor get the cell phones, get educated, get out of poverty without massively increasing their ecological footprint, because the organic farmers of the developing world are the only sustainable humans there are. We're
also without rushing into the cities and hastening the cities' collapse.
Yeah, absolutely. And because, you know, for example, 26 million Chinese went from the cities to the villages in 2009. Right? When economic conditions are better in the country than in the city, people stay in the country. They even go back home. So this is a really simple thing, right? All of the people that we have who are genuinely sustainable are poor villagers. They're on 1.0, you know, Earth's footprint, and we're all running on 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 footprints. So we don't know what a sustainable human being looks like, but I bet it's an organic farmer for now, and we can build on top of that later, maybe if we get the tech. On the other hand, Naxalism. Right? The Naxalites are Maoist-inspired insurgents who are fighting for the rights of the poor with a basically anti-civilization agenda all over India. Right? I mean, it's something like a third of the states in India have an active Naxalite insurgency, and you've got similar groups of different ideologies all over the world. You have a broad-based rising political anger in the poor who are looking at us and saying, those bastards, they're sitting there rich with the power to transform our lives. Heck, they could just stop screwing us in trade agreement. But they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And if they take the political route, what we're faced with is the possibility of an electronically organized global insurgent movement with billions of people who are potentially active. And if you think about the way that China gave birth to Maoism, it was a 20-year battle. I think Mao was in the field for 17 years raising support from all of these peasant villagers until he'd managed to amass such an enormous base of support that he went to the cities and became the overlord. Now, I don't think
it started in the field.
It started in the field. It started in the villages.
He started in the villages.
And this was the revolution of Maoism, that he managed to implement communism on an agrarian base rather than a proletarian industrial base. Very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And the Naxalite stuff is working that way right now. So, you know, we've got this historical juncture, right? The printing press tore Europe to pieces for 200 years. Protestantism, Catholicism, massive bloody wars, disaster. Now we've got something which is much bigger and more powerful than the printing press going into the villages of the world within the next decade, and we have to try and channel that energy down the constructive path or we're all screwed. The world will be awash with blood and fire if we do not get this right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only priority.
Let's pause there, because I think this might cause a couple questions from Kathy or Jaime or somebody else who's on the call, and because we're also getting close to the end of our time. So thank you for that exposition. It was as crisp as I was hoping. And any questions from the from our colleagues?
No questions from me. This is Kathy. I'm really interested to hear the one of the things that Tess and I were talking about before the call was the difference between pro-development and pro-poor movements and trying to understand the impact of pro-poor movements going forward. I would guess from what you're saying that the Naxalite is a pro-poor movement sitting here in the West, it looks like, you know, it's one I would put on the sort of dangerous, not so positive side of the spectrum. But I'm wondering, are there positive pro-poor activities going on that you're aware of? I guess in a sense, the Hexayurt revolution would be a positive pro-poor movement.
Oh, there's an entire country of positive pro-poor stuff. Do you know Kerala?
Uh-huh, yes.
Kerala, right, they've got a pro-poor government. They've got 60 million people, average income $1 a day, 76-year life expectancy, 95 to 99% literacy. Birth rates right in line with Europe.
Uh-huh.
That's perfect, right? I mean, they've managed to decouple human welfare from economic development almost entirely. Fantastic, right? We're not going to do any better than that. Dollar a day, 76-year life expectancy, below replacement birth rate, high education, perfect. There is an example of solving the problem correctly. Kerala in India, 60 million person state. It's the hopeful example of how we should run the planet in future in all the areas where we don't have much money.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and we're not going to get there through Naxalism. We're going to get there through democracy. Kerala's democratic.
So do you see a future then? So let's sort of move into our zone of forecasting the future. Do you see a future in which the Kerala experiment expands and changes the way that the wealthier part of the world lives, or are we creating two separate paths for humanity going forward, sort of economically, civilizationally?
Hmm.
What happens?
Okay, so this pivots on whether or not we fix our energy problem.
Uh-huh.
There's a whole bunch of work on ultra-cheap solar panel technologies. Wikipedia turns out to have a great page called Low-Cost Solar Panels, which has a really heavy review of all the technologies out there. So if that stuff comes through, we can keep a high-energy budget lifestyle, and the whole world will eventually be electrified, and then we can just figure out how to use less materials in consort with our cheap, clean energy, and we can have a pretty high-burn future, which is nonetheless very green and sustainable. That's the good path. If for some reason we don't get cheap energy, we're going back to the villages. We're going to run out of coal, we're going to run out of oil, we're going to run out of oil soon, we're going to run out of coal later, the climate will be all over the place, but eventually we're going back to the villages, and we have to hope that we manage to maintain our scientific and technical base somehow through that process. But I'm fairly confident, I think it's better than 95% likely, that we're going to get the ultra-cheap solar panels long before we run out of basic energy resources. The real, I think, fork is about urbanization. And I think that what we're going to discover is that as we go forward, the idea of always living in a city your whole life becomes less and less fashionable, and that people will go to the countryside to have their kids, they'll do a lot of work in the city, they'll go back again. And I think we'll see much more circulation between city and countryside, because that seems to be the developing world pattern. And generally speaking, if we had a better access to land in the developed countries, I think we'd all spend a lot more time on the farm too, because it's generally a nicer way to live. So I think more mixed life where, you know, in your life you spend some time in the city, some time in the village, and it's expected that people will kind of cycle backwards and forwards as their needs change, with, you know, the electronic communication network tying your life together. I think that's where we're going. And the other thing I would say is that economically, the massive advantages that were built during the colonial era, and particularly after World War II, where the West had, you know, America had something like half of the world's total manufacturing capacity for 5% of the population. So they were basically 10 times as rich as anybody else because they were 10 times as productive. Now Americans are nothing like 10 times as productive as everybody else. Capital is moving around the world. Advanced manufacturing is everywhere. We're heading towards a single global economy that we have rich countries and poor countries. It's got rich people and poor people. We're all basically for roughly the standard of living of Mexico. And, you know, 30 years from now, Louisiana and Mexico will probably have comparable standards of living.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's a very averaging that's happening, because the wealth is just basically sloshing around the planet uncontained by national boundaries. So it's going to find a level like the sea does. And if we're conscious of that, what that means is the rich countries are going to get poorer and poorer and poorer relative to the rest of the world for several generations. Our parents all owned houses by their early 50s. We were all struggling to buy real estate in our early 40s.
And what you mean by wealth, I think, is going to change over time, too. This whole notion of decoupling from the money economy and having well-being as wealth and so forth would be great. So I think a lot of notions are challenged by the vision you're putting in front of us.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah, we have unfortunately come to the end of the time we've booked together. So I think let me offer you a moment to offer any wrap-up thoughts you'd like, and then I will summarize and take us out of the call.
So I would just say, you know, we have the option to make the difference now. The West Coast tech community in America has the money and the understanding and the know-how to put the technologies onto the mobile phones, like precision agriculture, that will enable the poor people to lift themselves out of poverty by the non-destructive route. That's a difference that we can make right now. Google.org could do it in 2 years. So let's do it.
Love that. And I love your complete picture. This is I had a great conversation with you, and we've got a piece of that in this call, so I really appreciate it. So let me go back and recap where we've been. Vinay started with the Hexagrid project, and I asked, you know, how did that connect with the Superstruct project? And when IFTF Superstruct game showed up last year, Vinay saw it as an opportunity to do public thinking around very tough scenarios, and there aren't very many opportunities to do that. So he also really liked the problem definitions, where in some sense it was a mixture of science fiction with real life, because it lets you do the science fiction kind of best thinking about the future, but you had to apply those things to the real world today. So, and these weren't really technological problems run amok. They were problems of governance and disease and a whole series of things. So he had been working on the Hexa Year project back to 2002 when he went to a sustainable settlements charrette run by the Rocky Mountain Institute that was 80 people from 40 groups, and they were trying to reinvent the refugee camp, build a relocatable shelter. So the Hexa Year basically came out of that, and it's a model that can be built from, you know, 4x8 foot ply sheets, for example. That's the easiest way to build it. It tries to minimize waste from those sheets of paper, and it lets you create shelters that are much stronger than tents, better, longer lasting than tents, but can also be moved when you find a place to actually resettle people who've been living in a refugee camp where they don't want to actually be or where they shouldn't be. So you can send people home a village at a time. So the Hexa Yurt is a six-sided silver hat, kind of like a geodesic structure, that folds down like a concertina. It can fold together, and it has a lot less waste than if you're trying to build a straight up geodesic dome. Then the Haiti disaster happened, and Vinay had actually learned a lot from Pakistani earthquakes a few years before, which had been very serious, and he really had not succeeded in penetrating the relief effort there. So he was actually prepared to jump on this on day one and knock on doors and figure out what's going on. He wrote a piece called Hexa Yurt Country, which got picked up in several publications, which was really a reconstruction plan. And this got him connected to about 15 NGOs who were on the ground in Haiti, from Save the Children and Oxfam to the U.S. Southern Command of the military, to a variety of church groups, which are always in the lead in relief efforts. And it turns out that now the Hexa Yurt project is in the long wait. The tents are failing. A lot of people are really under plastic shelter right now. Building real structures is too expensive, and the storms are probably going to wipe out the tent cities that are there right now. So it's very hard. You can't go back and build normal structures. It costs too much. It's $1,000 to $3,000 per unit, which translates into at least $250,000 to shelter, you know, 1 million people, or less. So this is a personal effort. Vinay has basically built a cockroach entity here, something that is so low cost and so simple that he can withstand. He's not going to die for lack of funds. As long as he can pay for his hosting plan, he'll be fine. And he's seen these structures show up in places like Burning Man, where people go, oh, look, free design, interesting structure, let's go build them. And he points later in the call to the fact that Mao basically was out in the villages for 17 years before the Maoist revolution turned into a nationwide revolution, that he basically went around the countryside and got everybody actually doing the things before it turned into a large revolution. So then I asked him, so what is the kit that would actually let you build some kind of sustainable society at the village level? And he says, well, you can start with a Hexa Yurt, and then once you've got a shelter, then you need some clean water. So you need both toilets and clean water. There are composting toilets. He pointed to the Sulab toilet, S-U-L-A-B-H, in India. And there are also some simple water filtration systems. There's Biosan and Filtron, which use brick or clay pots. And Tata, it turns out, is coming out with a $20 water filter made with coated gravel or something like that, that could in fact prove to be a really big business for them worldwide. And it's funny, in countries like India, we talk about the bottom of the pyramid, and by the way, I just heard the term base of the pyramid, which I much prefer to bottom of the pyramid. But, you know, the people in the poorest 20%, they refer to as customers, and they've been selling to them for a long time. Back to Haiti for a second. Haiti has a real long revolutionary history, including agrarian reform. So there are 600,000 farms in Haiti, and they could have a massive successful agrarian economy, except their methods are really, really antiquated and not suitable to the land that they're on. So they could upgrade their yields by 2 to 4 times. So there are different ways of upgrading the yields, different kinds of methods and technologies and things you could implement, which would be part of this kit. But Vinay says, look, there are 4 levels of infrastructure improvement here. There's the household, where you can talk about the Hexa Yurt and stoves and toilets and farming methods. There's groups formation, where you have communications, transport, and workspaces. There are organizations that are sort of the larger organizational structures. And then there's the state. And Vinay has proposed something he calls state in a box, which talks about the jurisdiction, the organizations, the recognition of the state, the perimeter of the state, and who is in the state as a way of actually sort of instantiating that you can have a non-failing state, something that actually will start to grow upward. Kathy asks, well, how do you scale this up? What's the path? And Vinay said, well, there's 2 angles to that. One is materials, and the other one is know-how. Materials that are needed for this particular kit are really all common. They're mostly plywood and concrete and some screws. It's something that people can get to. And if they can't get to it right away, at least there's a global industry that can get some plywood to places pretty quickly. Concrete tends to be pretty common in most countries. So the know-how side is the hard thing, and one of the hardest things here is that No, you don't ever want to premiere a technology in a disaster. You don't want to start a new thing in a moment where your people's lives are really in the balance. So he needs to get Hexaears built in places before disasters to create a culture of it. And for less than $100,000, you could create small sort of demonstration villages of Hexaears in different places. And I was proposing that maybe there's a way to propagate the Hexaear model with actual for benefit structures that aren't all about relief, but that begin to model that kind of structure and the open plans of the model so that people are accustomed to them. Also, Hexaear, it's a very Lego-like. The structures are very standard sizes, and you can begin to hook them together and begin to sell and make infrastructure for the insides of the Hexaears as well, hanging them on the structures inside. So we need local implementations first, you know, and then figure out how to do this. A lot of development efforts stumble on their failure to localize, said Kathy. So how do we actually get people involved in this pre-design work? Vinay's not actually sure. We have very poor responses for preventative stuff, but he pointed to Burning Man and the U.S. DOD as examples of where Hexaears were taking off on their own. Tessa mentioned this innovation firewall that a lot of organizations have, and Vinay said, well, his success he traces back to reading The Anatomy of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn when he was an adolescent, that you know, you can demonstrate that an old regime is dying, but then it takes a while before the holders of the old regime basically retire or die off. So it takes 15 years before you have large-scale shifts like that. So he's expecting it'll be 2015 before there's a large-scale deployment of Hexaears and whatnot, and that's to us the cockroach strategy. You don't really want to get killed on the front lines here. You want to be able to survive this whole thing. But the military is also a really interesting path here because they're involved not just now in first war, second sort of defense, but now they're into state building of different kinds, and what Vinay is proposing is a kit that would actually help that. There's really no shortcuts here. And for unknown reasons, the refugee world, the world of helping refugees, is stuck in a World War II surplus era when the military have already gone through four generations of, you know, camping and survival gear, and the retail world has gone through 10 generations of all this gear. We're now, you know, light and fast and quick and really withstands the elements. So how does this all work? One thing he points to is in Haiti, for example, we need to count the dead and figure out what did they die of so we know what problems to solve first. Jamais asked the question, you know, what could you make these things with other materials? There isn't a lot of wood in Haiti, so is there a way to make this with scrap or landfill or other sorts of things? And Vinay says, well, not that he can tell. Part of the problem here is scale, that the order size is 100,000 and the problem size is 1 million people. So to get anything in those kinds of quantities, you'd have to have something that's already being made in those kinds of quantities. So even though he's seen things, substitute materials out of hemp or plastics, it's very hard to get that kind of scale. Kathy said, so how do we get involved? One thing is that there's a group that needs $5,000 worth of funding. Go to hexayurt.org and find out. They just need $5,000 worth of funding to do some structural engineering on the Hexayurt to look at winds and modifications and see how this works. And the other is really about people. He's looking for some freaks. He's looking for some people who are intellectual innovators who want to solve the world's problems. And here's a solution for ultra-cheap housing. Terrific. It's a component of a useful model of how to make things work. There's all, you know, it could fit together with solar lighting and a whole variety of things into a collaborative innovation network. So why do the NGOs not do this these days? In Vinay's opinion, NGOs are competitors with one another. They're all competing for donor dollars, and donors are suffering donor fatigue. So they don't collaborate with one another nearly as much as they could. So imagine that you ran a refugee camp that had 50,000 people and that was going to be around for some years. What would you create? You'd create a political representation model. You'd involve them in how to actually allocate the money that's coming into the camp. You might do a lot of these interesting things and foster a very democratic, very egalitarian, very sustainable method of doing things, but that's not generally how we run relief camps these days. So then I asked him to paint the future of what happens when everybody gets mobiles in the world, and then he started with a real, you know, statement that, look, we're sitting here, the richest 1% in the world, the U.S. is the richest, or the developed countries are the richest 25% of the people in the world, and since World War II, basically, these countries have allowed the developing world to rot. That, you know, in the developing world, it's like, ooh, can we get an even larger house or a larger car? And these other countries are suffering incredibly and being put under nuclear blackmail. Their economics, their environment, their military, they've been under military siege in different places. It's been really, really bad. So they're angry. That's the point he's making, is that these poor are very angry. And by the way, they're now empowered. There are 4.1 billion cell phones in the world. People have access either to a phone or to a village lady with a phone. And there's sort of two ways that these angry poor react. One of them is maybe what he calls a technological solution. Let's provide them with, on board these phones, in 2 gigabyte of memory sort of stored there, let's provide videos and text in multiple languages for how to, you know, how to double the yield of your farm, how to build a shelter, how to do all these good things, and how to create universal education. Let's just put it on board and create an open door to a sustainable, happy future for them. The other solution isn't quite as nice. He points to the Naxalite insurgency across lots of India, where people are basically creating a Maoist rebellion from the field. The poor are very angry, and now they're connecting politically. And there's a possibility that these global movements really begin to connect with one another, and we have billions of people actively in a global insurgency like this. There's a nifty way to bypass this, which is to show people a path to prosperity and peace, because the political process generally means upheaval and having to move and often war. So it's not something people actually want. He points to the fact that the printing press caused 200 years of turmoil in Europe. Rebellions, all sorts of things sort of got shaken loose, and there was a lot of violence in Europe after the printing press. So the mobile phones plus the internet are possibly even more powerful than that particular thing. So Kathy asks, what's the difference between pro-development and pro-poor movements in the world? And then they pointed to Kerala in India, the southwestern province of India, which is a fabulous positive model of pro-poor working. 60 million people in the province, life expectancy of 76 years, 95 to 99% literacy, and birth rates and mortality rates equivalent with the developing world. But they've successfully decoupled their well-being from global development and the need for dollar metrics. These people have not climbed out of the base of the pyramid. They aren't making that much more than the $2 or $3 a day that people had before, but their lives are much better. So Kathy asks, what does this mean? Does this mean we have to change how all the rich live, or do we wind up having two paths for humanity? How do we move on this? And one of the pivotal points here, Vinay thinks, is do we fix our energy? And if we do, then we might actually have sort of balanced livelihoods where people are moving back and forth. If we don't, then it's probably back to the village for all of us, because the cities are just not sustainable once energy dies off, once we can't actually fuel them. And he points to a lot of low-cost photovoltaic work that's being done right now. He's pretty optimistic that the energy problem can be solved because of low-cost photovoltaic sorts of things. So, you know, the U.S. Used to have half of the world's manufacturing with 5% of the people and be much more productive than most other countries, in particular at the end of World War II when other countries had been devastated by the war and nobody landed on U.S. soil. Now it turns out that we're not 10 times more productive than everybody else. There's one global economy, and wealth is just sloshing around the world, disobedient of all the old boundaries. So we have an option now to make the difference. We can actually prove these technologies, and we can put them out in the field and make them work in different places and lift people from poverty without the struggle, with actually positive ways. And that's Vinay's vision, and we're really glad that he shared it with us. So we've been talking with Vinay Gupta about Hexayear's much larger development issues on this fourth FutureCast call held on April 1st, 2010. Thank you all very much for joining us. Please feel free to tell others about these calls and to tell us how to make them better. We are open for ideas. For Kathy Vion and IFTF, I'm Jerry Mikulski. We'll talk to you on the next call. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of FutureCast, IFTF's ongoing podcast series. We publish these shows under the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can learn more at our website at iftf.org.